unlock the future of learning. This is Franklin Unlimited, where visionary ideas come to life.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of Franklin Unlimited. I'm your host, Will Campbell, founding head of Franklin School in Jersey City, where we're redefining what education can be for the next generation of thinkers, creators, and leaders. In this podcast, we explore the bold ideas, groundbreaking programs, and inspiring individuals that are shaping the future of learning. Today, we're exploring one of education's most vital frontiers, how different brains learn to read, think, and thrive. Every classroom holds students whose minds process language and meaning in distinct ways. Some struggle to decode words or sustain focus. Others see patterns that others miss. True support begins not with labels, but with understanding how the brain learns and how it can relearn. Joining me today is Dr. Kenneth Pugh. He serves as President and Director of Research at Haskins Laboratory in Connecticut, with academic appointments at Yale University School of Medicine and the University of Connecticut. He's a leading cognitive neuroscientist. Dr. Pugh's groundbreaking brain imaging research reveals how reading takes shape in the mind and how targeted instruction can rewire it. I'm so excited to have him on the podcast today. Let's dive in. Ken, thanks so much for joining us today. We were talking a little bit before we obviously came online and how excited I was and grateful I was for the visit up to the Haskins Lab and obviously showing me around Yale School of Medicine's facilities, which was incredible. So thanks so much for joining us today. And hopefully we're going to dive into some topics around neurodiversity, some reading research that you've done previously, but also the exciting grants and opportunities that you have coming your way as a leader in the field.
It's really a pleasure to see you again, William. And we all had so much fun when you came up to visit us in New Haven and to hear about the kinds of programs that you created that are really breaking down the barriers and doing very, very imaginative and very innovative work. And we were talking about what you were doing. I'm glad you enjoyed seeing all our research equipment and stuff, but we were talking about your program for quite a bit of time afterwards. So it's great to see you again and to have a chance to share.
Oh, wow. That's kind of like goosebumps for me because I left there being incredibly inspired, but also incredibly confident that what we were doing was on the right path, not only for our students, but our teachers in making sure that they're aware of the best support structures in place. And I actually called my wife and spoke to her about the program the day that I had. So I'm really grateful that your group actually saw value in it because that presentation in the boardroom to begin with, I was like, I better not drop the ball on this one or I'm out the door before we start.
Before we go further into all the conversation, I will tell you that we were discussing and there were a lot of really good thoughts about it. Then we got all get so busy, you and us. I think we should get back, have you up again and continue that conversation. But for today, it's the podcast here.
Yeah, would love that. And I'll take you up on it for sure. So look, with your area of expertise, the incredible work that the Haskins Lab has been doing for a number of years, neurodiversity and just reading in general and understanding of student and young people in relation to development has become, I think, far more prevalent and I think much more kind of understood, at least from different layers within education. And so today, to kind of just set the platform for everyone, I'd love to look at it more big picture. So when we talk about neurodiversity in schools and the challenges that students may have, from your lens and your perspective, what does that really mean?
Yeah, I mean, it's really a fundamental question. In some ways, it's helpful to think about how science progresses because it goes from looking at the average person to the individual very often. And that's what's happening in my field, which is a field referred to as cognitive neuroscience, where we are looking at a combination of cognitive measures that tell us a little bit about how kids acquire reading, what can go wrong in that acquisition, and $64,000 question, what can we do about it? Can we use this understanding of the biologic pathways and the cognitive systems to identify more effective treatments? But really, the whole focus over the years in my field of sort of mapping the brain bases or correlates of reading and speech and these differences It always starts with the question, what does the average reader do? We look at the mean, the median, and the mode, if you, for your listeners who remember their stats. And we're sort of trying to identify really what is most frequently encountered, what is most typical. Science often starts there because we want a model, especially for the cognitive and brain connections that are associated with that normative. But then we quickly have to realize that no two kids are the same, of course, and that the diversity that they have, if children are outside of the normative way of doing things like reading and speaking and listening and writing, there's automatically an assumption, well, if you're too far away from the average, that might be a problem. And of course, as you know, even better than I, you can have problems for kids who are diverse in their reading abilities, no doubt. But we also begin to realize that these kids bring their own talents, their own strengths, their own poetry to how their brains can learn and how their brains are working. I always talk about the brain because we spend so much time. It's actually the child. And as a grandparent, I always think of my kids as kids and not brains. But when I'm answering questions, I might say the brain. But anyway, these kids, these bright, interesting, beautiful kids that we study who are neurodiverse, they bring with their diversity opportunity, opportunity to learn, opportunity to understand how to teach to those diverse profiles. So in many ways, the science starts with how does the average head work? And then the question is, how does it differ from one person to another? And when we go there, especially in the context of learning to read, we want to understand heterogeneity or neurodiversity. No two kids are exactly the same. Then it becomes super important to have very sensitive ways of looking at an individual. And here's where, for those of your listeners who they see people like me showing brain pictures and yeah, it looks cool, but what's really the value added? My view has always been the reason as a cognitive scientist, I many, many years ago began exploring the wetware, as they call it in the biz, the brain pathways and using brain imaging, different kinds of brain imaging, is because it has an exquisite kind of sensitivity to those individual differences in ways that sometimes are even hard for us to quantify and measure with just our behavioral measures alone. But once we head down the path of diversity and neurodiversity, we have an opportunity to enrich our general understanding because we need to understand the full range. We also have an ability to learn from these children how they learn, and ultimately with folks like you who are doing this for real, how to teach to that diversity, how to teach to the talents and strengths that kids bring, while at the same time working on things that are critical for success in life. So diversity, neurodiversity is an area where we can expand our understanding not only of how the brain works, but also how to teach to it. And one last thing I would just say, when we're talking really about neurodiversity or diversity in general, just a couple of things that people might be interested, just from the point of view of how we progress in a field like the cognitive neuroscience of reading. So again, really, we have to spend an awful lot of time, and we have, understanding the normative model, how the average brain reads. And then that provides a foundation from which to launch out to understand what we call, and that's called nomothetic or average statistical research. But then we branch into what's referred to as ideographic or individual difference focus. And that's where we begin to see the complex ways in which diversity can add strengths as well as challenges against that normative model. And we're at a point in the field of brain imaging, for example, where we have much better tools to measure those individual differences that are so important to education. And one other thing, as before we move on, that I would really highlight is there is a tendency in society in general to say, I hope you're close to the average. I hope you're normal. I hope you're typical in some way for many reasons. But what we fail to appreciate enough is the power and the potential of diversity, of heterogeneity, and the ability to bring it out, as I know your school specifically focuses on. That was what was so appealing when we were meeting with you, because the ability to recognize the beauty of diversity rather than the safeness of having kids basically all learn the same way is something that not only should parents want to see and should educators want to see, but so should brain mappers.
So, Ken, that was one of the things when I was up there visiting with you that I really valued and loved so much was actually seeing the tangible examples of where all the research is actually starting to feed into the education spaces and generate just, I think, a more acceptable conversation around diversity, like you said, and neurodiversity. I think it's something that we do exceptionally well here at our school, and I appreciate you referencing what we do here. I get that question all the time, is what kind of student are you looking for? And I do the majority of the admissions process here with a great admissions lead as well. And the thing that I want them to understand is I don't want all of our students to look exactly the same and add the same value and be seen as these particular kind of cookie cutter conveyor belt models. Life is diverse. And you referenced the beauty and you said poetry before of what each student can bring. I love that about having a school that can actually look at the finer details on how to support a student that just needs access in one or two areas where they need some differentiated practice or they need a program that suits them specifically. And then all of the other doors start to open up. And then you see the beauty and the amazing individual pursuits that a number of students that may have a few challenges in some academic spaces, excelling and showing so many other students in other ways how to problem solve, how to challenge, how to have endurance, and then also just to build a self-awareness where you can actually be an advocate for yourself and articulate what level of support you need. I also love those components of it. One of your papers, you've got many, many papers, but one of those, it was from 96. I've done a fair bit of research. I loved your work, as you can imagine.
That's an old paper.
It's a really old paper. And if I'm pulling too far into history with how many you've got, you can just pivot and talk about something else. But within it, it kind of references, and it's talking about students reading and the successful reading of students and how it functions. And it's referred to as like the symphony of visual, phonological and somatic systems working in concert. And it just made me realize that when I came and visited you and you were showing me how sometimes those disconnects and the song doesn't completely work together and it jumps little areas when students are reading and developing reading skills. I'd love for you, if you can, to kind of simplify the reading process on how would you explain what happens in the brain when a child reads a word successfully for the first time?
Right. Well, thank you. And this is work that is even now we continue because we really started this work with using things like functional magnetic resonance imaging, which measures where activation is in different parts of the brain we call circuits and where the connections are from one to another. We use other tools like EEG to measure the timing of brain activity. We use a variety of things. Ultimately, though, we study the cognitive parts of reading. But in terms of the general question of what does reading entail, both a cognitive and in terms of what we've now learned about the brain, when all kind of goes well, and then how it might differ and when it doesn't. So first of all, as you noted, even the simple process of recognizing a word, something that kids who struggle with learning differences find often very challenging and slow, labored, and error-prone. But even that process, which takes place in the blink of an eye, to go from seeing the word to getting its meaning if reading as well, is a quarter of a second. And that's not a lot of time in the real world. But that's how the brain is processing. The question is, what is the child doing when it goes well? And what are they doing when they struggle in general? And then we can come back to the question of diversity and individual differences. So what we find in general is that good readers are very proficient at creating a kind of a triangle in their head where they're able to link the orthographic information, the letters, the phonological information, the phonemes, and the semantic and morphological information, meaning. And what they're doing is creating an efficient and automated set of connections that allow you to see, to go into the language, and to go into the meaning space in 250 milliseconds, which is a blink of an eye. So that process involves these three general dimensions. We call this the division of labor. And if you think about it, folks who are listening, When we think about reading, we think about, or even reading a word, simplest kind of reading. We often think about it as some sort of monolithic thing. But in fact, it involves different stages. And those stages go by in the blink of an eye, and you're not privy to them. You can't say, oh, I mapped from letters into sounds, and then I hung a left turn in some other part of the... You don't see this. This is what you are doing, and it's either leading to reading success or reading difficulty. And so what we've been able to see, first from a cognitive point of view, is that kids who find reading at the first stage, which is learning to read, later on it becomes reading to learn, and that raises a whole other host of issues. But in terms of initial decoding, it's really critical that kids have a strong phonological foundation, that they're able to create efficient mappings from letters to sounds and sounds to letters, and that all of this can provide a kind of a two-pronged reach into meaning, which becomes then more and more routinized, more and more, we say, automatic. And in kids who struggle, most of the time, we find difficulties in making those orthographic to phonologic connections. So we don't want to throw out the baby here with the bathwater. We do know a lot about how reading can go wrong for the majority of kids and how it can go right. And it has to do with this triangle in your brain. So the other thing that the brain allows us to do is to see where the triangle is and how it builds and how it connects. And there are a couple of things we've learned that help us understand why good reading is so intimately related to the phonologic skills, especially in the earlier stages. So you think about it, when you see a word, you're activating the visual parts of the brain. And when you have a word sound, you're activating the auditory and linguistic parts of the brain. And when you think about the word meaning, you're activating those areas plus additional areas distributed. I don't want to get too far into nerd land here, but distributed in different circuits around, particularly strongly in the left hemisphere. Now, when reading goes well, our work has been able to show that the vision to oral system, the receptive and expressive language areas that we all have before we ever go to school, that we're working with right now as you and I talk, expressive receptive language, we have a lot of information about how some of your listeners might have heard of Broca's, Wernicke's distinction, difference between output and input areas in left perisylvian cortex. These are just terms. But the idea or the finding seems very clear is that kids who are succeeding in this early stage of learning to read are those who are able to get from the visual representation, the letters, into the speech areas and use them to further process the language. So in some ways, it's as if good reading early on, one of my linguist colleagues wrote a paper, good reading is parasitic on speech. And by parasite, he didn't mean a bad parasite. He meant that an ability to take advantage of something we've been talking and listening for 300,000 years, and we've been reading and writing only for 5 to 7. So their ability to make those connections is crucial. And what we generally see is diversity and heterogeneity in whether those connections are being made. And we often see that kids who find word reading difficult are not finding their way to leveraging those speech and language processes that make reading so efficient, so automatic. So now we've seen it. Here's the brain when it all goes well. Here's the brain when things go different. And now the next question is, what does this imply about learning and teaching? Well, at the very, very, very early part of reading, not the part you deal with in comprehension and older kids, we really have to pay attention to strengthening that triangle. And the brain imaging data is very helpful in seeing how a child is progressing and in understanding heterogeneity or individual differences in any group. For example, some child might find the connection with the oral language systems harder than others. Others may struggle more with memory and attention. All of these things are in different knowable brain pathways, brain patterns. So this gets us back to where we started, Will, which is that if we can see into the mechanisms of reading and language and memory and attention and executive function, we're able to understand not just what systems need to hang together, but how one person might be fragile. Fragile is just a word in one part, and another child might be fragile in a different part. They both struggle on behavioral testing of reading, but for very different reasons. So the conceit of brain imaging, the promise of educational neuroscience, if it delivers, is to be able to understand that even in things that flash by in the blink of an eye, but involve lots of brain networks working in a coordinated way, it's the possibility that we can understand the individual differences by understanding where the stronger connections are and the weaker connections are. And that differs from child to child. The basic idea is this: there are some connections that need to be made, particularly links with the speech and language areas. They often aren't made for kids who struggle. We want our interventions and our education to help strengthen those connections if possible. But there's also a lot of diversity, which we started with, and the brain measures and the cognitive tools can help us to understand those differences. Then it brings up the hard question, which is, can you teach to those differences? And I know that's something you're thinking a lot about. But to your question way back yesterday when you asked it, basically, we know a fair amount at this point, after many, many years of research, about where the connections are and where they need to be. And then it's pretty easy to see where they're different. And then, as much of our recent research does, and we can talk about it if there's interest, is once we have those differences clear between even the average good reader and the average struggling reader, even if we're in that zone, we can begin to say, does a given intervention or treatment or learning opportunity in the right dose and the right age, in the right moment in time, at the right time of day, does that help to move the brain into a more efficient pattern? And that's exactly what we're doing in my NIH projects these days. But it was all dependent on the early work that you alluded to, which is, how does the brain read? How does that change? One last interesting thing I think your listeners might also be interested in from the point of view of reading and speech. All good teachers of early reading can tell you good reading depends on good, strong oral language, particularly phonological processing, and that's well established. But what you may not know, your listeners may not know, is that when you learn to read, it changes speech and proves certain capacities in oral language, because you've done so much changing to these brain networks that you've actually strengthened them. So learning to read depends on speech, but learning to read can change speech, and sometimes change it in ways, people that struggle with oral language, in ways that can be actually beneficial. So it's very complex, it's very multidimensional, and all those kind of things that we do when we analyze the data. But in some ways, there is some neuroimaging support for your grandmother's intuition, if your grandmother were a reading specialist in the Orton days, which is, good reading is dependent on the oral language connections. So that's a long answer. I hope maybe we can edit as needed, folks, or answer questions on it. But that's sort of my spiel.
No, look, I love it. And the reference to Nerdland as well, I love this, because that's probably the reason that you and I spent 8 hours just kind of chewing the fat and talking about everything in your research.
Exactly.
But the synergy, and I think one of the reasons we hit it off was, I really love seeing all aspects of research or deep diving into any ways that we can help our students, our families, and our educators learn just how to support each other better, but also create new avenues of learning. And so you gave me a great segue there, where it's kind of trying to find a way where we can get more people aware of the neuroscience, the data that you have, and then providing spaces for this to go through pilot processes, trial and error, further research, just to see whether or not, as you referenced, the right moment with the right person in the right environment at the right time, well, you need to have those in order for those things to actually come to fruition. And so you do incredible work where you bridge, and you spoke about the bridging in your response just before, bridging neuroscience and then classroom practice. And that's one of the reasons why I really read so much into your work. Is a lot of people now are referring to it as neuro-guided remediation, so stepping into that space and having neuroscience play more of a role. If you could create the perfect environment, what do you think it would take for schools to move from being informed by neuroscience to actually then be guided by it? Because they're two obviously very distinctly different things.
there's this discussion of educational neuroscience. A lot of teachers go to conferences that people like me speak at, Learning in the Brain, many others, that are meant to share what's known from neuroscience that's relevant to education. So first of all, educational neuroscience is founded on the premise that if we can teach to biology, if we understand the biology better, including the neurobiology, we can develop better programs that are brain-informed and brain-friendly and executive function and attention and arousal and anxiety mitigation friendly. And this is all what we hope to do when we bring neuroscience and education together. In our Haskins Global Literacy Hub, where we're doing work in many parts of the world, the first principle of our work is to bring teachers and researchers into the same room to learn from one another. This is where you and I had such a wonderful day of talking about your ideas about how to educate and our ideas about how to measure these things. But it's important for your listener to understand that for the first 20 or so years of this brain imaging that people like me have been involved in, a lot of the work was like this. We know an effect, we know some practice for working with kids who struggle, let's say, that we know from many, many years of good clinical work, of good education development, and of good educational and psychological research. So what we were doing in the early days is we were taking those things, which didn't come from neuroscience. They came from education, psychology, and your grandmother's wisdom. And we took those things and we mapped them into the brain. And everybody got really excited because I can tell you how kids who struggle and kids who don't struggle differ in the way these networks get connected. But then if an educator comes and asks me, okay, so all that stuff you've done to help us understand, including neurodiversity writ large, now what are you going to tell me for the classroom, Ken, that I don't already know? And I would say, I'm not there yet, but right now, the classroom is telling me, the education theorist is telling me what to look at, and I'm finding its neural correlates. But good science takes a long freaking time to get things right and to be sophisticated, and also to have the right technologies to measure really subtle things. So here we are now. There's a lot of knowledge. And there's, of course, a ton of knowledge that comes from psychology and education about this process of taking a brain that talks and listens and turning it into one that can read and write as well. And so this moment in time is where you start to really get interesting and where educational neuroscience will either be worth its salt or it should be smacked upside the head. Because when we're worth our salt, then what we're doing is we're using these sensitive measures to say, for this kind of child, for this pattern of control, executive function, memory, attention, language, speech, it looks like there are some connections that are particularly strong. In other words, teach to the brain, teach to diversity. We're starting to see in many laboratories, patient laboratories that were willing to be boring for 20 years, just finding out how the brain works in reading and how it differs in dyslexia and how to treat it. Now we're at a point in my lab, many others, where we're actually saying, I think we've learned something that would generate some hypotheses that if a child shows a certain pattern, it's more likely that they need a little more from column A or a little more from column B to bring out their strengths maximally. So the point where we're at now in the research is we're trying to actually deliver on this idea that we can understand the difference from one child or one kind of learner to another. And by that, I don't mean the typology that's so prevalent in education, but really type in terms of how the brain tends to be stronger or optimally structured. In any case, we are now doing work where we put the caps on. The latest thing we're doing, and we try to see whether different learning experiences produce a more efficient brain pattern on the fly in real time, many, many months before we would ever see a change in behavior. Now, I'm doing that work, and I got nothing to tell educators about what that work tells you about the classroom. And if I did, I should be smacked. What I am saying is we're really getting further, rapidly faster at translating the Educational Neuroscience Foundation to what educational neuroscience hopes to do, which is to teach to the brain. And we're beginning to see work, even things, something your listeners might have heard called neurofeedback, where you put an EEG cap on and people do different learning kinds of situations, and you can see where the patterns are becoming more efficient and reinforce those patterns. It's used in ADHD, it's used in so many areas, but it is kind of where things are going. In fact, with AI being so powerful and scary, but powerful, we actually can get to a point now where we can watch the brain responding in real time and try to see if different experiences change differently for different kinds of learners, et cetera. Last thing I would say before you pull me off with the hook is this, and this is kind of important. So in education for the past 100 years, there's always been a common sense intuition that unfortunately has not, in the mainstream, had a great deal of success. But where I see people like you succeeding, and I think neuroscience may be a good ally, and that is, of course, individuated instruction in the conventional research on, for example, with reading or math or reading comprehension, but especially learning to read. And we know that no two kids are alike, and we know that there are different strengths and weaknesses, and your grandmother should know that we'd like to teach to those. And despite all those, we know, research, large-scale research conducted under the auspices of the NIH, which funds my work and many other people's, weren't super thrilling on individuated instruction in the main. And it comes up every certain length of time because it's obvious we'd like to do this. But you know, and William, you know more than I, how these debates go back and forth. What I think when I see the kind of work that you do, which teaches to interests and to strengths, but also maintains the core, okay, of what needs to be there, and then marries it to what the individual child needs. That's where we need to go. And here's my pitch, folks. Brain knowledge is a really good ally in beginning to deliver on individuated instruction. But if anybody comes on the radio or the podcast or whatever this generation calls it and tells you that we already know what to do from brain imaging, give me their phone number. I'll give them a call. We'll talk. My people in Brooklyn will talk, okay? Because we don't know everything we need to know yet. But we're getting, well, even in my own grant, my own research right now with kids, I'm getting excited about this. So anyway, long answer, but we should be teaching to the brain. We needed to know what the brain looks like before we teach to it. And that's a lot of work, and a lot of work's been done. There's still some questions, of course. But I think we're ready now to go. Actually, one last thing, if you don't mind.
No, please.
So we and many other groups over the years began to do brain imaging, like fMRIs, before and after treatment. Some of our early work, the Shaywitz, Pugh, Blackman work and other things, and many labs around the world do this. So here you do. You have kids who are good readers and they have these really strong reading is parasitic on speech kinds of networks. You can see them. They're going, I love my speech, and they're there. And then you have kids who are struggling and they're not making those connections. And so one of the things, and we know where the brain differences can be seen, even though we don't fully know why they happen, we at least know where to look. Now you put the child in most of the research in treatment, like my colleague Maureen Lovett's Empower treatment in out of Hospital for Sick Children in Toronto, or our colleague Benita Blackman's work in Syracuse, or many others that are evidence-based, that reinforce the triangle, orthography, phonology, semantics, and do it right. And we put kids through pull-out treatments 1 hour a day. We look at the brain before and after, and lo and behold, the brain changes when reading gets better. It's exciting. People love this and it's important. But yeah, so if reading changes, the brain becomes more efficient and we can see it. But, and so all of that work was important because it establishes how treatment, and treatment's just a word, experience, when it's good, changes the brain. Great, right, guys? You listening? But it doesn't work for everybody. So guess what? In a good treatment study, 70-75%-ish might really get real gains of kids, these bright, beautiful kids, and 25-30 might not. And unsurprisingly, the ones who are gaining are getting the biggest brain changes as they must. We don't read through our hands, we read through our brains. But what we're now doing, Will, and what we've been doing for some years, is asking the question, what is it in the way the brain's connections are made that makes some kids respond to a conventional evidence-based program and others not. And the more we understand the not, the kids who are diverse, this is where diversity comes back, even diverse within a struggling reading sample, the more we can test ideas about how to teach to things we can see that are different in those children. For example, if kids who don't respond to treatment have more problems in self-regulation, and we can monitor some of those connections, then we can begin to say, we still need the good stuff, making those connections that any reading teacher knows, but maybe we need to marry it to some things that strengthen other connections in the brain. So even there, even in the big studies that have been conducted, there is a tease, a very big and good tease, that individuated learning is rapidly coming in the field. So I'm a scientist and I'm boring and I give you these overlong answers, and your podcast, they can just turn it down and turn it back. But if you turn it back now, we know a fair amount about the brain. We know that educational neuroscience has promise. Sometimes it hasn't yet delivered. We would like to reach a point where we teach to biology. I think we're getting closer.
Yeah. I don't think you have to apologize at all for your responses. One of the reasons I really wanted to get you on, and this has almost been a year in the making.
I know.
Is because of the stuff that I also saw up there. The work and the fact that you're not rushing through these processes and you're really trying to get as much correct, solid, sound information as possible. But at the same time, you're wanting more people to be a part of the process. And so I will ask you one quick question, and then I think it would be great to hear about some of the future projects you referenced. You spoke to me before we got on about the grant that you've just been giving and some of those processes there.
Right.
But I think for me, the really exciting part when I was up there is the fact that the amazing research that you've done, you're constantly going through cyclical processes of review, improvement, different approaches, getting rid of the stuff. You said a slap up the side of the head a few times if you don't get things right. But it's that idea of constantly trying to improve or get closer to where there are actual new metrics, new technology, or even new initiatives that we can put in place for our students, our educators, et cetera, to try and meet those people and actually improve as many spaces as possible. And so that was a long kind of segue to me asking you this question. But having seen so much of your work and the fact that it does have a synergy, I also have seen pivot points. And so I'd love to have our listeners hear, when you look back at the decades of research around mapping the brain, decoding, dyslexia, remediation, what was one discovery that changed your own thinking about how humans learn and how the brain functions?
That's a great question, Will. And I would say there's a lot of things in the minutiae of neuroscience about how extraordinarily plastic the brain can be at many ages and in many ways that continue to amaze me, frankly. We've also made discoveries that have blown me away about how learning occurs and how it depends on the brain's mix of chemistry and signaling. I mean, there are 86 billion neurons here, okay? It's almost as many neurons roughly as stars in the galaxy, right? And these systems give rise to beauty and to cognition and language and memory and poetry and reading and philosophy. All of this, we're now seeing its magnificent complexity better than we used to be able to with these new tools. So as I go forward, I'm constantly amazed at the brain. But a few things I've learned, sorry to be boring on this, but I got to say it, it's really amazing how clear it is that there are different ways to build a reading system. And some of them are not so effective. Some of them are. And other things being equal, every child's different. We could talk about this, or if I talk to families, but generally strengthening, especially in the preschool time, the oral language competencies, the openness of the speech and language brain so that it can be leveraged for print, which is an old idea. This is what good teachers, good remediators, good specialists in dyslexia know. But to see it, literally, we had a study. One nerd study, and I'll stop. We looked at a large number of children who were in about first grade and came into our study at Haskins and Yale. And we did every kind of measure you could imagine, genetics and brain imaging and cognitive testing and say the word cat without the first sound, which is called phonological awareness, which is a very strong precursor of good reading, especially in our language. And we did all that stuff, and then we followed kids for several years. And what was amazing in that study, which was published in Preston et al. In, I think, 2015, what was amazing in that study, it was so clear, is that the kids who ended up with stronger reading comprehension, and these are the kids who are eventually going to get to you, who need to be able to use reading to learn rather than learn to read, that the kids who ended up in a somewhat better outcome were the kids who were most likely early on to be trying to connect to the speech areas when they were learning to read, which is also what good instruction tends to focus on, which is also a core deficit in dyslexia. So in all of that, which I might have been able to say 100 years ago if I was thinking about it, what amazes me is how precise and clear the brain tells us these stories. And then how even in any population of kids, we see bumps and we see differences that need to be taught to. That's one part of the answer, Will. And the other part, in terms of what is now really amazing me, is how resilient learners can be if we reach them where they live. You know this better than I because you're an educator of children. I'm a lab nerd, but it's extraordinary for me to see this. And it makes me appreciate back to the first issue, which is neurodiversity is a sacred blessing to the world when we understand it and can teach to it and play to it. And again, I very much know from learning your program how you individuate, how you teach to these things. And that's one of the reasons that I was so happy to come back and maybe to talk in the future about further collaborations. There's some other things. And if you'd like, I can also tell you a little bit about our latest approach to studying this amazing biological systems and how to optimize learning. Here's what I wanted to tell your listeners about this. So this goes back to the average head and the individual difference. We are now beginning some work in Connecticut, New York, with a new way of thinking about using brain imaging. Okay, so you ready, listeners? So what we do is we do a deep, deep dive into an individual. I don't mean literally we open their brain, but we are studying them over a period. We are tracking. It's called small N or small sample or single subject brain tracking. This is all the rage in my world, folks. And what it is when you have enough insight into the way the brain learns and you've done the big studies and you have the bigger data, then you can start to watch individuals learn. So for example, when I'm trying to give a child experiences that I know will be beneficial to language learning, when I track them very precisely and over time, I can actually see the difference from one child to another. And I can see the changes and when the changes occur in one child versus another. And then we actually reach a point where we use the signal we get, the measurement we get, to begin to try different alternatives. I mentioned this at the beginning, to teach to the individual. So the science right now that maybe blows me away the most in broad terms, the thing that is really exciting is this ability to understand the way in which an individual changes over time with these complicated measures in our toolbox. And one example that I'm currently working on in my research, we are doing this tracking. We're trying to see with the kids that actually have these cute brain caps on while they learn, and we're trying to see the difference from one to another and then to manipulate the kind of input, the learning, the experience, to see which kind of brain pattern is most friendly to a certain. So it's kind of obvious in a way, but complicated in practice. But here's another thing. We know that in these complex, bright children that I study who learn differently, there's elevated levels of anxiety and there are elevated levels of a variety of other what are called internalizing disorders. We all know this. We live in a world where anxiety is on the rise across the board. But we see this in these kids. And one of the things we know is that there are ways to mitigate anxiety. Mindfulness, for example, we're doing work with mindfulness training in order to create a more stable way of being to allow the child to focus appropriately on the content. Well, that's obvious in a way, or common sense. It should work like that. So now we're doing studies where we can actually look at whether mitigating something changes the way the brain is learning something else. But more simply, more realistically, children are complicated and lots of things contribute to learning. And I still have to strengthen the triangle of orthography and phonology and semantics in every child. But I need to teach to where the maximum struggles are for that child. And if we can mitigate those, so much the better. We normally do studies with 20 kids, 30 kids, 40 kids, but the neuroscience of precise brain-guided learning, it's almost the cousin of what some of your listeners might have heard of as personalized medicine. But it's a very different kind of use of the tools we have in this field to really try to challenge ourselves to teach to the individual. And those are the things that we're collaborating with schools and with colleagues on in various fields, from psychiatry to education, to see if we can teach to an individual. And as I said, I'm getting old and I've done a lot of this work. I would love to see this succeed for the next generation of children and researchers both.
Yeah. We're almost towards the end of the podcast, and I think you and I probably should catch up a few more times over the next couple of months, because I think we could sit here and just talk through this stuff and plan for it and try to see how we can move the needle and make differences and also bring joy to as many students' lives as possible, whether it's this generation or the next 40 generations. And so as a bit of a thank you and a round it off, I'd love for you to tell us, I know you were talking a lot about your research there, but if you can just give us some kind of real fine details on the grant that you recently were awarded and the connections and work that you're doing with some of the amazing institutes in the city in Manhattan.
Yes, of course. And I would, before I jump into that, I got to throw a shout out to you. Let me just say that one of the things that I was so impressed with your program at Franklin is how it's multidimensional, and it is allowing the child's progress to shape a more individuated focus of learning and more of a reinforcement of what could be very different dimensions for different kinds of learners. So you're already doing this in the classroom. And I think that my little brain cap kinds of things that we do with this tracking is the natural ally, because we can potentially get a sense of why things are likely to hang together. Like, you find certain things in education hang more closely, certain skills go together, certain dissociate. We can look at the brain pathways that are involved. So in research, we're very interested. I'm now looking at programs like yours because they're not individuated, but appreciative diversity and teach to diversity. And I think that the research that's going to change the neuroscience and the ways in which then the brain contributes to the education more is by putting the kind of things you do together with the kinds of not only brain tools, but complicated ways of doing statistical analyses and stuff that your listeners would truly cry if I start going into machine learning this, machine learning that, AI this, AI that. But simply, we're getting better tools and better analytic procedures to understand the very first thing you started with, which is diversity. You're teaching to it and learning from it. This is the kind of thing that I hope my students and your students will be doing in the future. And the other thing I would say to, from all my years in looking at this, is I would say that we are seeing the natural evolution of the big idea of educational neuroscience slowly, but systematically, coming to a point where I think we will be able to do much better by children than we're currently doing. Otherwise, I wouldn't be saying these things and doing these things. And finally, children need to be happy, and they need to be calm, and they need to be believing in their beauty and their competence. And I'll end with a little tiny story. And William, you know this, of course. So we often, in studying reading disability, see where the brain connections are weaker. Because if you're not reading well, certain connections haven't been made. It's not pejorative. They're not there. And we're trying to train them. So we're always focusing on deficits and getting rid of deficits. But neurodiversity suggests that the genes that build brain and propagate in the environment that make some children struggle with reading or math or something else, ADHD, they're going to produce other benefits. And all parents know this, and teachers know this. It's hard to quantify. But I think what we can see right now with a simple example that I'll end with is this. We did a study where we found something that dyslexic children do way better than controls, good readers. And it's a weird thing. Some of your listeners may know. I'm happy to share papers with anyone who reaches out to you. I can share. We published this some years ago. But when you look at a figure, a two-dimensional drawing, kind of like an Escher drawing, which is hard. If I ask you to determine, could it be possible in three dimensions or is it impossible? It's a weird little thing. Children who have reading disability on average do better and faster than kids who read well at seeing that, no, this is possible, this is impossible. This is often thought of as a potential talent and strength, this visual spatial thing in the dyslexic world. And lots of people debate it and lots of people research it. But we know about this one weird thing where the kids read worse, but they impossible figure better. They're better at this, what's called configural visual global processing. So we mapped it into the brain using an MRI. And what we found, also my grandmother would have predicted if she were in neuroscience, was that the kids, when the good readers are reading, they're more efficient. And when the poor readers, who some people think are weaker brains, they're more efficient. And they're using these pathways more efficiently for something not related to reading. And so this study, which we did with Gordon Sherman, who runs the New Grange School in New Jersey, a school that teaches not only to fix that triangle in reading that you got to focus on, but also reinforces strengths and talents for children who learn differently. He was part of this study. He was a neuroscience by training. And we were able to show that if you find something that that child's brain loves for whatever reason, they're not a medically different population. They're a diverse population. And I always see that, just that weird study, that we could see the reversal, the trade in brain, as evidence of the immense capacity of any child if we find where they live. And so I would end with that.
It's a great way to end. It's almost like a full circle, because that was almost the way that you started the podcast, was celebrating diversity and also acknowledging the poetry and the joy and the amazing things that students can bring if you give them those opportunities and spaces. Ken, want to thank you so much. We definitely need to connect again sooner rather than later.
For sure. You got to come up here and I'll come down there, but we should be doing the study where your programs and all their complications and our measures and all its complications can hang out together a little bit.
It sounds awesome. Thanks so much for joining us, and that'll end it for today.
Thanks, William, and see you soon. And to your listeners, whoever is there in the world I can't see, if you're interested in any of this crazy things that I'm saying, we're scholars first. We'll share whatever we know, send papers, send reviews, things like that. Happy to share. And hopefully you'll all maintain interest in the partnership that education and neuroscience can do if we're actually listening to each other. So thank you so much for having me.
Thanks so much, Ken.
Bye, guys.
That wraps up this episode of Franklin Unlimited. Again, I'd like to extend a big thank you to Dr. Kenneth Pugh for joining me to discuss the ways that schools can support neurodiverse students and the importance of neuroscience. It's about creating classrooms where all learners can thrive. If you'd like to learn more, we've included links to some helpful data in the show's notes. And of course, thank you to you, our listeners, for tuning in. If today's conversation piqued your curiosity or gave you a new perspective, be sure to subscribe to Franklin Unlimited so you won't miss any future episodes as we continue exploring the leading edge of education. If you'd like to learn more about Franklin School and our mission to empower the next generation of leaders, please visit us at franklinjc.org. Until next time, keep pushing the boundaries of what's possible in education.